This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Conjoined twins Chang and Ang Bunker toured the world in the mid-1800s. They put their bodies on exhibit for all kinds of audiences. Eventually, they settled in rural North Carolina, where they became slave owners and fathered 21 children, but they were never quite able to escape the public eye. Many accounts of their lives focus on their disability and appearance, but my guest today wanted to explore what their story tells us about the changing racial and cultural landscape of the 19th century in America. Joe Orser is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire, and he recently published the book The Lives of Chang and Ang, Siam's Twins in 19th Century America, and he joins us now. Joe Orser, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about the early life of lives of Chang and Ang and how they ended up in the United States.
They were born in 1811 in Siam, which today we know as Thailand, in a small village about 60 miles southwest of Bangkok. And truly, we don't know much about their early childhood. We know that by the 1820s, they were living on the outskirts of Bangkok, and that was when they were first seen by Europeans. By a Scottish merchant named Robert Hunter. And it wasn't until 1829, when they were 18 years old, when Hunter and an American sea captain named Abel Coffin teamed up and brought them from Thailand, or from Siam, first to the United States and then also to England, and placed them on tour.
All right. Well, tell us about those tours and about them exhibiting their bodies. What did those exhibitions look like?
Early on, in 1829, 1830, they were still fairly young. There was actually a great exhibit of their kind of the physical feats they were able to do. Those included acrobatics or somersaults. It included them playing badminton. It also, they put their kind of their wits on display as well. They played chess in front of viewers and that sort of thing and lifted up spectators in their chairs. Later on, those performances would kind of become more sophisticated and less kind of spectacular, and deal mostly with placing the twins in a parlor setting and having conversations with them while at the same time putting their bodies on display.
It's interesting. You point out in the book that they had a deep level of engagement with community leaders, medical professionals, and ultimately they would take control of their own tours. But tell us about that, about their personal engagement with the people they came in contact with.
They were very bright. They were very savvy when it came to taking stock of the landscape around them, and especially the people around them. And they understood, who had power, what types of language was important. So, for instance, at one point early in their lives, they were referred to as the Siamese boys. And this had been after a couple of years in the United States and England. And they said, you know what? We don't want to be called boys. Boys refer to a lower class, someone who is not as sophisticated and mature as we are. And we would prefer it if you referred to us. And they said the Siamese young gentlemen. But they were very kind of aware, conscious of the class and racial landscape around them. And so they did. They made connections with businessmen, with lawyers and legal professionals, and especially with medical professionals, in an attempt to kind of leverage their position into one that was advantageous for them. And they were also able to provide, advantages to those people who came into contact with them.
And those medical connections were important because they found themselves having to certify the fact that they were, in fact, conjoined.
That's correct. And so on the one hand, they had doctors write letters of authenticity certifying that, yes, these brothers are in fact conjoined. And on the other hand, the doctors were able to use the twins to kind of boost their credentials and say, you know what, I've examined one of the wonders of the world, and they would put that on their CV as well.
You took a look at a number of newspaper accounts across the country and detected some pretty serious regional differences in how they were perceived around the country. Tell us about that.
Sure. In If you look at the way that the twins were discussed in northern newspapers versus southern newspapers, for instance, and this will vary over the course of their lives, the northern newspapers were, especially once the twins had, this was later, once they had married and were having children, the northern newspapers took a much more critical view of the twins. They condemned the circumstances that the twins had created for themselves in terms of marrying white sisters, having children, to a degree that southern newspapers never did. If you look at by the late 1850s, 1860s, when the twins were in 1860 visiting California, and Western newspapers were writing about them, the Western newspapers, West Coast newspapers, were writing about the twins colored through language about Asians in America, the Chinese that were becoming very prevalent in the West Coast. And this was a language in the United States that hadn't often been used to describe the twins. So different regions kind of describe the twins differently depending on local circumstances.
And here in the South, of course, the racial binary defined forever how they would be classified as white, because you're either white or black in the South, particularly in that pre-Civil War period.
Certainly, at least you know, early in their lives, that's absolutely the case. And in fact, you know, they were able to come to the South. They settled in North Carolina. They became landowners. They became slave owners, and they made all sorts of certain claims to American citizenship and whiteness. They became American citizens at a time when technically, citizenship or naturalization was limited to free white persons. And so the twins made all sorts of claims to whiteness that were largely accepted by their white neighbors in the South.
And before all this, of course, before they settled, they had actually taken control of their own business, as it were, their own exhibits. They broke free from Abel Coffin.
Yes, and this was a kind of a confrontation that was rife with kind of racial animosity. The twins felt that many Americans, because of the terms of the contract, many Americans viewed them as slaves. They felt that they weren't, didn't have enough say in the circumstances of their travel and their exhibit, and they weren't being paid well enough. And so, yes, in the early 1830s, after they had turned 21, they made a very concerted effort and successful effort eventually to break the bonds with Abel Coffin.
And how successful were they on their own as both the exhibit and the sort of the managers of their own tour?
In the 1820s, or rather in the 1830s, right after they had broken with Abel Coffin, they were very successful. They were able to maintain the manager that they had used with the Coffins, who had a lot of experience, and they traveled up and down the Atlantic seaboard. They made trips to Europe. They even went to Canada. They went to Cuba. And so they traveled internationally, and until ultimately in 1839 they decided to retire. So they were very successful as businessmen, as independent businessmen.
You know, it's interesting. One of the episodes you point to in this book that I think shows how they became part of the racial binary in the South was when they tried to get exemption from, and they may still have been with Abel Coffin at this point, tried to get exemption from the exhibit tax in Virginia. And the case made by the Virginia, at least one legislator, was that this would only, by exempting them from this tax, would only enrich a northern slaveholder. So Abel Coffin still in charge at this point. But the idea that they were seen as slaves and that this would be the rationale for denying them an exemption was the case in a state like Virginia.
Yeah, and this was again, local. You asked earlier about local circumstances. This was a summer. Directly after there had been a very kind of vigorous debate in the Virginia Assembly over slavery and the question of perhaps engaging in a gradual emancipation, which had been defeated, but the twins' kind of circumstances were all tied up in that that debate over slavery in Virginia at that time. And you're absolutely right. At that particular moment in time, this was 1831. If I remember correctly, they were absolutely still connected with Abel Coffin, and they were kind of talked about in very audible terms by, you know, by leaders of the state of Virginia as slaves, and that upset the twins tremendously. And in many ways, that kind of served to kind of push them to stake their claim for independence from Coffin.
And whiteness when they moved to North Carolina and became slaveholders. Tell us why they decided to move to North Carolina.
As far as I can tell, and this is nothing new that I'm presenting, but they were able to strike up a friendship with a doctor in Wilkes County, North Carolina, by the name of Callaway, and in 1839 they decided to kind of end a tour in and an extended tour of the South in Wilkes County in Wilkesboro. And they kind of arrived there in June or July of 1839, and began immediately to make connections with political leaders, with business leaders, and legal kind of leading lawyers and law officials of the county. And soon enough, they had bought property. So I don't know the extent to which they actually had planned to settle down, but they kind of felt at home enough that within months they were starting to kind of buy property and establish a residence for themselves.
They did. They both married sisters and had 21 children, the two of them. Tell us about their family life here in North Carolina.
They married in the mid 1840s in 1843. Their first children were born within 6 days of one another the following year. And they had children quite regularly throughout the 1840s, so that by late 1840s, early 1850s, they had enough children that they had to kind of expand, and they kind of moved north from Wilkes County to Surry County, just on the outskirts of Mount Airy, and they began to build two separate residences for themselves. So the twins maintained separate residences, one for Chang's family, one for Aang's family, and they would travel back and forth. They would spend 3 days at each of those residences. They took a very kind of engaged roles in the upbringing of the children, in trying to provide educational opportunities for their children, in kind of overlooking the crops that were grown, the managing of the slaves. They played the roles that a farmer with property would play in those days.
We are talking about the lives of Chang and Aang today on The State of Things. Author Joe Orser is with me, and how were they received by the community? How was life for them and their families?
For the most part, as far as we can tell, to their face, they were received fine. There was some gossip. I've uncovered some letters about the twins that kind of talk about, oh, they went to the revival meeting and it's important to note they went with a couple of leading community members. And so as long as they had, as long as they had those connections, they were received pretty well. They had money, they had celebrity, and they had connections, and ultimately they were, they had property and slaves. And so for all of those reasons, they were received quite well. Now, to the extent to which they were talked about and looked at outside of the public eye, in terms of, in private circumstances, private homes, there are sources that talk about the ways in which, many of North Carolina residents and Southerners discussed the ways that the twins' visual appearance disgusted them, and so there were different types of discourse about the twins depending upon whether it was in a public setting or in a private setting. Ultimately, by the end of their lives, the racial landscape of the United States changed, the ways that their neighbors kind of dealt with the twins would change as well, become more negative. But early in their lives, there's no evidence to suggest that that type of ugliness was directed at them in explicit terms.
What did you discover about the inner lives and the psychological effects of their lives in afterlife in the public spotlight?
I think that, for me, one of the greatest discoveries was, again, the pride that they had in themselves as performers and in their families, the kind of tenderness that they showed towards their children expressed in letters back and forth between them and their wives and their children. And also kind of the real awareness of the fact that they were always on stage, that people were looking at them, were talking about them, and that would always be the case. And they kind of came to accept that. And some letters, they make very clear that this is just the world that we live in, and we just have to deal with it.
What do you know about their legacy and their descendants in North Carolina?
They have, at this point, they've got a very kind of great legacy, I think, in North Carolina. They have more than 1,000 descendants who gather every year in Mount Airy, every summer in Mount Airy, North Carolina, to kind of celebrate the twins and their lives and their legacy. There is, in Mount Airy, there's a museum that also has a very fine exhibit on the twins. And so at this point, which is to say in the early 21st century, those communities and their families really embrace the legacy of the twins. This wasn't always the case. In the 50s, 60s, and before, it was often the fact that someone was a Bunker was often kind of kept undercover, but ultimately, at this point, it's celebrated and embraced.
Joe, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joe Orser is the author of The Lives of Chang and Eng, Siam's Twins in 19th Century America. You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.